Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
You're about to listen to a new episode of the Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast with Sean Martin. Have you ever thought we're selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Well, perhaps we are. Let's look at how we can organize a successful information security program that integrates business culture with people, process, and technology to drive growth and protect business value.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
And hello, everybody. You're very welcome to a new episode of Redefining Cybersecurity here on the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network. I am Sean Martin, your host, where if you follow the show, you know that I get to talk to all kinds of cool people about interesting things impacting business and businesses, customers, and ultimately society as a whole. We're all trying to wrangle the best cybersecurity programs possible. We're flooded with new threats. We're flooded with new technologies to help us with that. It gets complex on both sides. And then, of course, all that only matters if we're helping the business to grow. So that's my objective, is helping operationalize security so that we can protect the business and help it generate growth and revenue, of course. So today we're going to be talking about an industry that clearly knows a bit about money and finance. We're looking at the financial services sector, and more specifically, the ISAC for financial services. So the FS ISAC, and I'm thrilled to have Cameron Dicker on. Cameron, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I didn't get a chance to make it to San Diego, to connect with the broader group. I saw a lot of posts online where folks are really thrilled with the summit you put together, for the FS ISAC and bringing the community together. So I'm thrilled with that. So maybe word on that at some point in the conversation. Before we get into what we're going to talk about today, though, a few words, Cameron, about what you're up to, your role, and why FS ISAC is something you care about at the moment.
Yeah. So I'm the Director of Global Business Resilience. So my program is a global program, as the title suggests. We do exercises for our members. We also manage a community that brings practitioners together from risk, resilience, crisis management, business continuity to share best practices, do assessments on what we think the greatest risks to the sector are from an operational standpoint. And then, of course, when something does go wrong, the community functions as a sounding board so that we can talk about what we're seeing, what we think the risks are to the sector at that moment, what the impact is likely to be on the consumers, the sector. And of course, share best practices on what people are doing to address the operational concerns at the moment.
Yeah, no lack of fun stuff to dig into there. And I like that you bring people together. It's not just a feed of information, but you're actually pulling folks together to help them understand what's going on in the organization relative to what's going on outside the organization. I've had a few conversations with a few of the other ISACs, Space ISAC and AI ISAC, and working on getting the automotive folks on. For those who haven't listened to those, please do, first off. But maybe an overview of the ISACs in general, and then the specifics of FSISAC? What's your charter? Who are the members? Kind of give us that picture to start.
Yeah, so FSISAC's been around for 25 years. As one of your previous guests mentioned, it is one of the first ISACs. We're very proud of this. We've really grown over the years. We're in 75 countries. We have over 5,000 member organizations. And just to the point you made earlier, one of the things that I think is sort of specific to our size ISAC, or at least not universal across the ISACs, is that we really are a place that brings our members together to share among the members. I like to think of us more as a node network. We are 5,000 organizations across the world seeing a variety of different hazards across a number of different threat vectors. And what the ISAC is a place for those people to come together and say, hey, I'm experiencing a problem or I'm seeing a thing. Who else has seen it too? And what did you do to address it? So it really is member-driven from its core. Our focus is collecting from the membership, analyzing with the membership, and providing back to the membership what they can use to bolster their own resilience and security.
Go ahead.
I was just going to use that to pivot into sort of our general structure. We like to think of it as three pillars. We have intelligence, resilience, and security. And these pillars sort of go hand in hand with each other. As I mentioned, think of the ISAC as a node network. So intelligence as a pillar collects that information, synthesizes it, validates it. And then security and resilience take that information, analyze it, process it, work with the members to see what's relevant, what's not, what's of value, what do they actually need, and what can they then add to the analysis piece? And then we provide it back out through running exercises to strengthen our process, through the development of playbooks at the sector level, or through best practices documents. And here's how we would address this problem. Here's how others are addressing this problem. And here's what we've seen that works versus doesn't work.
I love that. Thanks for doing that. What I want to touch on is the global nature of this. For those who are aware, the ISACs were founded as a government initiative, correct? And one might think then it's limited to U.S. companies. Of course, especially when you get in the financial sector, many of those organizations operate internationally on a global scale. So it's not a surprise to me that you have so much presence in other countries. But maybe a few words on that, because do you see differences between how FS works in North America versus Asia versus Europe versus APAC?
Sure. So as you noted, we are global because banks are global. If we take any lesson away from the recent financial crisis, it's that we're all very interconnected in this sector and impacts are global in nature. So as an ISAC, it's important for us to have a global presence, because if something happens in London that has dramatic operational impacts on a significant London bank's ability to operate, that's going to have impacts in the United States. It's going to have impacts in Australia. So it's important for the security of any institution that they're getting that sort of intelligence and resilience best practices and coordination on a global scale. So when we then look at how this actually works in practice, you do see some differences in how the regional banks operate. Even the same bank across multiple regions. You find that because in the United States, there's been strong public-private partnership for over 20 years now, that the conversation between government partners and private sector works a little more smoothly. There's a little bit more trust, a little bit more information sharing than what we see in a lot of places overseas that are just getting started with this process.
So when I talk to a lot of practitioners, a lot of the conversation is we have all this tech, we're trying to figure out how to use it to mitigate risk, reduce exposure, communicate back to the business what we're doing for them. It's a very bottom-up approach with then some wrangling, usually at the CISO's, sitting on the CISO's shoulder. How do I translate what I'm doing with my team back to the business to say, one, we're providing value and not just mitigating risk or helping to mitigate risk, but to drive growth ultimately. Where I believe FSISAC and other ISACs have an advantage is you kind of look at the market and what's going on across the business of financial services and the objectives there. And that then could potentially drive back down the other way. So is that a correct assumption, or are there other points that you'd make in that regard?
Yeah. So the way I like to think about it is from a financial institution, it's all about sort of improving business efficiency and reducing risk. And IT was a huge boon for the financial sector in this space. It allowed smaller institutions to gain access to services that they could have never afforded because of the just resources required to run something in a manual process. It allowed large institutions to run them cheaper and more efficiently, which then moved a lot of process from sort of that wholesale large investor piece to the retail market, which is ultimately good for consumers. And it also bought down a lot of risk from other threats. If you are, say, a financial institution in Florida, traditionally your worry is something like a hurricane. Through innovations in IT, you can have a data center in the cloud that's running in Ohio. So that when the hurricane comes through, you switch to your Ohio data center, everything keeps processing, everything's great, except for your physical building, which of course may need some repairs, which allows you to really reduce the amount of business risk you take on from being in a hurricane zone. This really played out for the financial sector in the pandemic. When a lot of sectors moved to working from home, the financial sector was already so heavily invested in IT that this was in large part not a huge problem to overcome. We already had the capabilities in place. We were already, even when we were in our office, remoting from the office into wherever it is we stored our data. So it was largely a mind shift change, a couple regulatory concerns to overcome, but not a huge change in how we do business, which allowed us to be incredibly resilient to the COVID pandemic. Now, the problem with this is it introduces its own risks. IT radically proliferates the attack surface. Now, my cell phone, this computer, are huge risks to the company because the company can't lock them down the way they used to. It's now on my Wi-Fi. I can do things. I can download personal apps on my phone. So it introduces new risk while mitigating the old ones. So the question that FSISAC grapples with often is how do we look at all of the new IT that's coming into the sector and understand its business value and also its sort of cyber and operational risks that come with it, and then communicate those properly to the membership.
So maybe using the cloud transformation as an example. So in that sense, or in that case, did you, because that's basically, we have new technologies, gives us new capabilities. We're gonna the whole thing about that is scale, right? cloud yeah. Scales. So we can do so much more efficiently, maybe even less cost. Did you bring the members together to say, here's what this means to our sector. This is how we think we should approach it. And here's how we look at risk in that. Or was it member driven where they're saying, we've been told we're doing this and we need help understanding what it means? Or is it kind of a combination of those?
So it's a combination of both. And I actually started the cloud conversation in the sector from my previous job as a member of FSISAC. where I was the Deputy Director of Response and Recovery for the Department of Treasury's Office of Cybersecurity and Critical Infrastructure Protection. And the FSISAC and Treasury partnered together to run a series of tabletop exercises on cloud to try and identify what we thought the actual risks were today and 5 to 10 years in the future. Those started, I want to say 2019, a little bit before the pandemic. Since then, we've had several follow-on exercises to measure our progress, see how things are going. There have been a couple papers. I believe Treasury published one 2 years ago, almost. And then the sector, through FSISAC and organizations like the Financial Services Sector Coordinating Council, have created several working groups to look at cloud and its risks and its uses in the financial sector from a variety of lenses. And what's, I think, great about the model we've chosen is we've invited the cloud providers into the working group to work with us on those risks so that they understand sort of where we're approaching this from. They can dispel myths and rumors. They can tell us about mitigations they have in place that aren't necessarily public. And they can work with us to make sure that the things we've identified in exercises get addressed before they become problems and incidents.
I love it. And yeah, no, they, in fairness to a lot of, number of the CSPs, cloud service providers, certainly the larger ones have invested a lot in different sectors. I know the healthcare space, obviously financial, critical infrastructure. They invest heavily to understand the needs of that market. Because when I think of financial services, it's all about onboarding new customers and getting their transactions completed, right? With minimal hiccup and limited liability back to the company to have to cancel that transaction. I want to bring it to before I go there, talked about cloud, we talked about remote. Are there other areas that you see other areas where we're heading that might be as impactful? I can think of a couple, like Gen AI, hard to avoid that one as a topic, but another one that strikes me like something like open banking, where everything's driven by API. So are there things like that you see on the horizon where the members of this group really need to start to think about?
So one that's not on the horizon, but is sort of, we're in the thick of it right now, is the proliferation of sort of the use of third parties to run financial services. As I mentioned earlier, there are great efficiencies in doing so. As those get concentrated into one or two service providers for a function, this introduces a lot of risk. There are times where if a service provider that is not regulated in the financial sector, perhaps even not federally regulated at all, may not have the standards in place that a typical financial firm would have for cyber controls or incident response capabilities. So that then becomes the weak link to the financial firm. But it's not just a one-to-one. If the third party goes down, it has the potential to take thousands of financial institutions with it. If a core banking provider goes down for a week, that could easily be 3,000 or 4,000 banks that are essentially not banks for 3 or 4 days. And there's very little in their control to do about that other than try and find a new vendor. And what we've learned from exercising is that onboarding a new vendor is not a week-long process. That's a 6-month to a year-long process. So unless you had one waiting in the wings, your backup plans are really not great in a lot of cases. Yeah. So that's the risk that I look at that it keeps me up at night. Turning to future risks, FSISAC has spent a lot of time looking at AI and the concern of post-quantum computing breaking payment algorithms. If we can't have confidence in the data we transact, we have a serious problem in the financial sector being able to operate. If right now we know that when I encrypt the data and I send it to you, it hasn't been modified and it hasn't been read by anyone. if we lose the confidentiality piece, that's not great. But if we lose the integrity piece, where we say, okay, someone could have gotten in, changed a number here and there, and continued on with the transaction, it undermines the entire system. It is something we've begun to exercise. We've started looking at, and really the question is, would we know that post-quantum has the ability to break our cryptographic algorithms, or would we just be in the dark for years while this is happening to us? And once we learn, is there a safe alternative, or do we just accept the risk? These are things that our working groups are currently working on.
Yeah. And two things come to mind there. So I don't know how many years ago, it was probably 10 years, maybe, I don't know, 15 years, perhaps even. I believe it was the Estonian banking system was compromised, and a number of transactions were not real or not authentic in some way or another. And I was working with a company out of Estonia to help solve that problem. And then the other point in terms of being in the dark, I've spoken to another company recently that their position is a lot of the data necessary to crack, and the data that would be valuable once exposed through cryptographic or quantum reversal. They're saying a lot of people are collecting that now. So that once it's possible, they can go back across gazillions of things for many years and get lots of information. Obviously financial services data or the transactions are pretty real. I don't know if it matters changing a transaction 3 years ago, maybe, who knows. But anyway, it's interesting times for sure. And I guess that really hones in on, I think a lot of people do miss the mark on integrity. I think there's a lot of focus on privacy, the confidentiality piece, and availability, which I even mentioned too, right? How can we onboard somebody quickly and get their transactions through? The resilience is a key part of that. Obviously, that's where you focus a lot of your time. Tell us a little bit more about your role and some of the things you do. You mentioned the playbooks and like that, but talk through some of the stuff you work on with the members.
Sure. So I would say the bulk of the activity my team focuses on would be exercises. We provide exercises to our members in a variety of different types. We have sort of technical hands-on keyboard exercises that we provide that just allow bank SOC analysts and network defenders to stay sharp on their skills. We then do tabletops at the policy level, and these look at the threat landscape that we gather from the intelligence pillar and from what members bring to us through our exercise community and say, hey, our bank is really, really struggling with X, Y, and Z. Can we look at that? We run a number of these every year where we bring people together and they share best practices. We try and assess where we think the actual gaps are. And then we write a report that says, here's what we learned, and here are 5 things we think you can do about it. We have a committee in each region that sort of collects those, works with members to spread the word, kind of tracks, if it's within FSISAC's wheelhouse to do something, tracks that we're actually looking at it and doing something. These are also great opportunities to bring our government partners in and say, you know, we get that you're interested in doing a rule on this thing. Here's what we know about it. Here's where we think the actual risk is in this space based on these exercises. Come exercise it with us so that when you write the rules, you're informed on where the actual risk is and what are sort of the red herrings in this space. We then have what we call functional exercises. And these sort of look at what we learned from the tabletops and say, okay, you have a policy in place that says you can do these 3 things. Now's the time to put your money where your mouth is and actually prove that you can do what's in your policy. So we spend a functional exercise is usually 2-2.5 days, and you act out the actual steps to see if they actually work. Are you missing anything? And what's great about those exercises for a sector level is that ultimately, there's always something new that you uncover that you get to work on again. So these are my favorite because the problems are relatively endless, but at the same time, you see constant improvement year after year after year. We've been doing these in the sector for, I've been exercising with the sector for almost 10 years, and I've seen tremendous improvement when we revisit topics and run them again. So the functional exercises, I think, are great for measuring that. Outside of exercise.
Yeah, because I want to pause there quickly because yes, you could have a policy. Yes, you can have the technology that helps you implement the policy. But if you don't have the operations or the procedure down and your team doesn't know it, right? Like it has to be second nature. I was talking to somebody the other day of somebody new in baseball or softball and catching a ball hit to them at first base and throwing it to get somebody else out at a different base instead of tagging their own base. Just not having that second nature. Well, I do this, this, and this in that order because of this scenario. But if the scenario changes slightly, I'm going to do this and this and this differently. So I think having the context and the practice is super important. That comes back to the team and the procedure and exercises, like you say.
Super cool. I mean, we see a lot of people writing their plan. We would call FSISAC.
Yep.
Great. How do you do that? Who makes the phone call? And mm-hmm. Who in FSISAC do you actually call?
Cameron.
This allows us to build that. Please don't call me. I have been the hotline person for many years at a previous job. Don't call me. We have a hotline for this. Call the hotline.
Talk to me a bit about, I know you're going to go somewhere else as well, but quickly on the rules and laws and regulation piece of it, because that plays a big part of context, especially when an organization operates multinationally, right? So there are rules in different countries they have to follow as well. So how does that all come into play? And are there must be benefits to the members by connecting with folks who operate like them in multiple places?
Yeah. So I guess kind of wearing previous hats at the same time, I used to work at the Federal Reserve in supervision and did a little bit of this international coordination on rulemaking piece. Each jurisdiction sort of fiercely maintains their own authority to write the rules that they see fit. And you see this play out, especially in the cyberspace, especially on incident reporting. Everyone has their own idea of what they need to collect and when they need to collect it and from who they should collect it. And I think for multinational banks, this becomes quite the hurdle. You could find yourself reporting to 3 agencies in the United States and 12 overseas about the same incident, and all of them have a different report they want you to fill out. I get that that's a challenge. It is a thing the members share amongst themselves to figure out, how do we standardize this? How do we make this easier on us? How do we make sure we're not pulling people out of the fight, as it were, to fill out a report? And I think those are important discussions to have. The ISAC doesn't have much of a role in that sort of act of harmonizing these jurisdictions, but we do have a role in holding the exercise with, say, the US regulators and the UK regulators, so they at least know that a firm operating in both places has to report these very different reports, trying to get at the same, essentially, 2 questions. So at least everyone understands what's going on. It creates that introduction to make sure that the right people are talking across the pond, and that those conversations are done in a safe, non-attributable environment. And that's really where FSISAC thrives.
Yep. Yeah. And it's that safe space that I think really, really matters, because clearly the initial objective was to share threat information. Right, active attack or potential threats, and what you're describing is much more actionable and operational and strategic in many ways by bringing different folks from around the world together for those exercises. How does that, by having the exercises, doesn't mean you eliminate the intel sharing piece of it. So how does all of that kind of fall back to the intelligence sharing, the information sharing?
Yeah. So as I mentioned when we started, intel feeds a lot of the resilience stuff. So the exercises are based on the intelligence. Our assessment of impact is always based on intelligence. Our crisis response, again, based on the intelligence. The feedback piece back into intelligence is sort of where we have the analysis of, here's from an operational standpoint, the interconnections of the sector. You've identified that there's an incident happening here. And what we've said is that if this goes down, these things over here go down. And it gives the intelligence team now a focus to look here as well. So it gives them not just the point in time what's wrong, but a chance to sort of look into the future with our analysis and say, downstream, these are people we should be talking to and seeing what they're doing and then sharing with them so that they can harden their systems today against what we think might be a problem tomorrow.
So what's a success for you look like? Is it growing membership? I know a lot of organizations track response time and bringing that down, bringing risk numbers down might be another thing that matters to them. How do you quantify what you're doing really matters and is working for you as an organization as well as the members?
Yeah. So I try not to look at the incidents. People are always going to find ways to rob banks. It's where the money is. It's never going to stop. The moment you alleviate the threat you're looking at today, new ones will replace it immediately because the incentive is just too high. What I view as success is, are we learning from the exercises? Are we learning from the past incidents? Or are we making the same mistake over and over and over again? For me, success is that the new problem we're facing today isn't the exact same problem we were facing 5 years ago. We've at least moved the needle. Not that we've reduced the risk. I think we're just changing the risk. But are we adapting? Are we growing?
I love it. And as we close here, and I'll give you a chance to say any final words you like, but a question I like to ask is, given what we talked about today and your role, looking at resilience across the financial sector globally, what do you think your sector specifically needs to do to redefine security? What can we do differently?
That's a big question. So I think there are a couple things. I think to really enhance our security, we do need to share more and more often. I think our community does a very good job of sharing. Certainly better than we were doing 5 years ago. Definitely better than 10 years ago. The things we're very good at sharing, though, are the IOCs, indicators of compromise, which is fantastic. But if we could move to that next level and share what are the actual, practices we're seeing by bad actors in our network? What are the tactics they're deploying? What are we seeing that we can actually use that isn't going to be unique to the incident? IOCs are so easily changed, but threat actors tend to stick with the tactics they've got. If we get to more sharing around that, those things that carry over from attack to attack, I think that improves the sector's resilience significantly. And then, as anyone who's ever dealt with our exercise program knows, I think we need to move the exercise needle as well. A lot of our exercises focus on a fictional firm experiencing the problem. And then we discuss, if we were the fictional firm, what would this be like? Or if we were partners to it, what would that mean for us? I do think we need to move from talking about fictional firms in our tabletops to talking about the actual firms that would be experiencing this problem in real life. I think that depth that comes from really looking at real firms provides a level of analysis that you just can't get from a fictional firm. And those are the pieces where we're going to, that's the part where we're going to find the real sort of nuggets of what to work on that are really going to enhance the resilience of the sector. But it's hard. It's scary.
Yeah. The extreme would be let's cover a real case.
Yes.
Which even more value there, but probably even a little more scary.
No one wants to be the one who for 4 hours is talked about as having failed.
No, exactly. Hopefully we get closer to that point though. I think that's the only way we really learn. So I'm thrilled to hear about all the cool things you're working on, and maybe a final word from you, Cameron, on call to action for current members, pending members, the financial sector at large.
I think my call to action would be get engaged. If you have a topic you're interested in, chances are FSISAC's looking at it. It's not just the hardcore cyber folks. We have business continuity, we have fraud. If you are looking at a risk, we have a community for you. Get engaged, get involved. It's how we make progress as a sector.
And if anything points to the community, I mentioned at the beginning, but a lot of positive feedback that I've seen online from the stuff you pulled together, most specifically around the recent summit you had. So Cameron, thanks a million. Thanks for doing what you're doing and bringing folks together to have those important conversations. And thanks everybody for listening and watching today. I'll put links into the show notes to connect you to the FSISAC and any other resources that Cameron wants to point us to help us continue to learn about what's going on there. So thanks again, Cameron.
Thank you.
And stay tuned, subscribe, share, and keep well, everybody. Thank you.
Pentera, the leader in automation security validation, allows organizations to continuously test the integrity of all cybersecurity layers by emulating real-world attacks at scale to pinpoint the exploitable vulnerabilities and prioritize remediation towards business impact. Learn more at pentera.io.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast with Sean Martin. Please take a moment to rate the show and leave a comment. And remember to share the Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues. Come back for more conversations and follow Sean Martin as he continues his journey towards redefining cybersecurity.